hobbies for many years, I have been collecting science books. I like science. And you can ask any of my kids or ask my wife, when I get bored, which isn't too often around our place, I just read science books. I like science. Taught it for 15 years. Even though I'm not teaching it anymore, I still like the study. It's so many neat things to learn. And there's an awful lot of good science in these books. But folks, there are some lies in our science books. I'm not against science, I'm not against schools, I'm not against teachers. My brother's in his 34th year teaching public school. My mom retired from teaching public school. There's an awful lot of good godly teachers in the system. But there's some poison in these books. And we're going to cover some of that tonight. Richard Dawkins, who hates creationists, said, "It is absolutely safe to say that if you meet someone who claims not to believe in evolution, that person is ignorant, stupid, or insane, or wicked." Well, Richard, I'll send you a copy of this tape, because I'm going to show you 100 reasons why evolution is so stupid. We need to define a few terms, okay? According to the dictionary, stupid means lacking normal intelligence, foolish, silly, a stupid idea, dull and boring. I think evolution is stupid. Now, my mommy used to get mad at me when I used that word, so it's a little hard for me, but Bill said, "Brother Hovind, I want you to preach on 100 reasons why evolution is stupid." Okay, Bill, well, you asked for it, so here goes, all right? Let's define some other terms now. The word evolution has at least 6 different meanings. And I've done 58 debates now, and if you're going to get into a debate on evolution with anybody, you better first define what you're talking about. Because this is a very slippery term, okay? First, we have cosmic evolution. That would be the Big Bang. There is no evidence whatsoever for that. We'll get into that in just a moment. Then we'd have to have chemical evolution. See, the Big Bang supposedly made hydrogen. Well, how did we get 92 elements, plus the synthetic ones? I mean, how did the chemicals evolve? They don't talk about that much, but that would have to happen. Thirdly, we'd have to have stellar and planetary evolution. But you know the stars would have to evolve. There's an awful lot of stars out there, folks, but nobody's ever seen one form. There's enough stars out there that everybody on Earth can personally own 2 trillion of them. We've never seen one star forming. We see them blow up from time to time. It's called a nova or a supernova. We've never seen one form. One professor told me one time, he said, "Well, we calculated in the laboratory that if 20 stars explode near each other, it'll produce enough energy to make a brand new star." I said, "Well, that's brilliant. You've got to lose 20 to gain one. You ought to run for Congress. You could help those guys borrow their way out of debt." Man. First place, that's all theoretical. We've never seen it happen, okay? And I think it is scientifically impossible. See, then we'd have to have organic evolution. That would be the origin of life. How did life get started from non-living material? Now, according to the evolution theory, that would have to happen somewhere along the line, long ago and far away. Life had to come from non-living material. And yet, we've never seen that happen. There is no evidence that it can happen. We'll talk about that in a minute. Fifthly, we would have macroevolution. That is where an animal changes into a different kind of animal. Nobody's ever seen a dog produce a non-dog. But the evolutionist believes a dog came from a rock, if you go back far enough in time, 4.6 billion years. Finally, we have microevolution. Now, I don't like this word, okay, because it gets people confused. I think we ought to just call it a variation. But microevolution happens, folks. That is a fact of science. Animals produce a variety of offspring, but it's always the same kind. The first 5 definitions of evolution are stupid. It doesn't happen. It's certainly not part of science. It's something you have to believe in. They teach the kids it all started with the Big Bang 20 billion years ago. A Big Bang. I like to ask them some simple questions. What exploded? And where did it come from? And where did the energy come from? Et cetera, et cetera. According to the Big Bang theory, it all started with a little tiny dot and exploded and spread out over all the universe much faster than the speed of light. Well, the Big Bang Theory, as we'll see in a minute, is stupid. I don't know of a better way to say it. I'm trying to be nice to them, but it is just stupid. The Big Bang idea started with a Belgian astronomer named George something, can't pronounce his last name. George said that this original matter was no more than a few light years in diameter. At the very least, that would be 2, or about 12 trillion miles. So they started off teaching at a spot 12 trillion miles across was what exploded. Well, they revised that down. In 1965, they said, no, it was only 275 million miles across. Well, that's way down from 12 trillion. 1972, they said, no, it's only 71 million miles across. I don't know how they know this stuff, but this is what they taught, okay? 1974, they said it was only 54,000 miles across. 1983, they said it was the trillionth the diameter of a proton. Now they're saying it's nothing at all. Nothing exploded. And here we are. This is what the textbooks teach. 18 to 20 billion years ago, all the matter in the universe was concentrated into one very dense, very hot region that may have been much smaller than a period on this page. That's stupid. This one says, all of the matter and energy someday will once again be packed into a small area, no bigger than the period at the end of this sentence. Then another big bang will occur. It happens every 80 to 100 billion years. So you can forget about global warming. We're going to get squished. Now this textbook author was brilliant. I could not believe how smart this guy was. He said, boys and girls, nothing really means nothing. You have to be at least that smart to write a book. He said, not only matter and energy would disappear, but also space and time. However, physicists theorize that from this state of nothingness, the universe began in a gigantic explosion. What? Yes, boys and girls, you see, nothing exploded, and here we are. Now, who can argue with logic like that? Man. They even put this in major science journals like Scientific American. This fellow said, the observable universe, that would be us, could have evolved, there's that word again, you got to watch that one, okay, six meanings, from an infinitesimal region. In the Greek, that means a dot. It's then tempting to go one step further and speculate that the entire universe evolved from literally nothing. They call that science and put it in a science book. I would call that stupid and put it in the garbage. This is what the books teach. I collect them. I've got hundreds and hundreds of these books from countries all over the world, clear back from 1890s up until the 2001 textbooks. They're teaching this kind of stuff, folks. This one says, all the matter in the universe was drawn into this little tiny dot, and it spun faster and faster. This is what they teach the kids. Some kids doing this for homework tonight, right? It spun faster and faster. One day, it exploded. Big bang. I was talking to a professor from Berkeley one time. I was sitting on the airplane next to a professor from Berkeley University. I don't know if you folks here in Idaho ever heard of Berkeley or not. But Berkeley is not a Bible college. So we got talking about the Big Bang, and he said he believed in the Big Bang theory. I said, yes, sir, I figured that. You have to teach it in Berkeley. I said, tell me, sir, how did the universe get here? He said, well, 20 billion years ago, all the matter was squished in this little tiny dot, and it was spinning real fast, and it exploded. Big Bang. And pieces flew off and became the galaxies and the sun, the moon, the stars, and finally, you know, people. Here we are. I said, sir, could I ask you a couple questions, please? You know, one of my favorite things to do in life is asking questions to people who believe in evolution. I absolutely have a wonderful... That's how this whole ministry started. 12 years ago, I moved to Pensacola, Florida. Some article came out in the newspaper that said, dinosaur bones found in Montana from 80 million years ago. I wrote my first letter to the editor in my life about 12 years ago. I wrote a letter to the editor. I said, yes, they found dinosaur bones, and yes, it was 40 feet long, and yes, it was found in Montana, but it was not from 80 million years ago. This one probably drowned in the flood in the days of Noah, 4,400 years ago. And you would have thought I shot the sacred cow. Actually, I did. Boy, there began to be quite a battle in the newspaper, letters to the editor flying back and forth, and finally a university called me and asked me to do a debate with one of their professors. Well, I'd never had a debate in my life except with my wife, and I lost those every time. I was not excited about debating, but I said, well, how do you do it? What do you want? And the guy said, well, you send us 30 questions, and the other guy will send in 30 questions, and we'll discuss those questions for the debate. I said, okay. So I sent him 30 questions. I thought they were perfectly legitimate, fair questions. I said, a woodpecker's tongue goes all the way around the back of his head and comes on top of his left eyebrow, left nostril here. Would you please show me any fossils that have been found, intermediate species between a normal bird and a woodpecker, you know, with his tongue going all the way around his head? What evidence do you have of how this evolved? That question never came up. I don't know what happened to it. But I said, termites chew on wood and they swallow it, but termites can't digest it. It goes into their stomach, and there's little tiny critters in their intestines that actually digest the cellulose. Now, those little critters can't live without the termite, and those termites can't live without those critters. Which one evolved first? I thought it was a fair question, but it never came up. I don't know what happened. I think they lost my list. But anyway, one of my favorite things to do is asking questions to people who believe in evolution. So I asked this professor if I could ask him some questions about the Big Bang. He said, sure, what would you like to know? I said, well, sir, you told me 20 billion years ago, all the matter in the universe was squished in this little tiny dot, and it was spinning faster and faster and exploded. I said, where did all this matter come from? He said, well, we don't know that for sure. I said, okay, now, sir, hold it. If I told you that I believe about 6,000 years ago God created the heaven and the earth, like the Bible teaches, you're going to say, and where did God come from? And I don't know. But you said 20 billion years ago there was a big bang, and you don't know where the dirt came from. So basically, I believe in the beginning God, and you believe in the beginning dirt. Don't tell me my theory is religious and yours is science. Oh, no, sir, they're both religious. The news media tries to make it look like it is religion versus science. I did a debate in El Paso, Texas here recently, and the news media wrote an article. They said, religious and scientific leaders debate evolution. What is the unspoken message in that title? What are they trying to imply? Can you catch that? They're trying to imply that evolution is part of science, aren't they? No, evolution is a religion. Actually, both creation and evolution are inherently religious. These two timelines is the same information right here. I'll be referring to that throughout the seminar here. I cover this thing all the time. The Bible teaches about 6,000 years ago, God made everything. 4,400 years ago, there was a big flood that destroyed everything. 2,000 years ago, Jesus came. Here we are today, waiting for the Lord to come back in about 5 minutes. This is the Bible view of history. On this chart, 1 inch is 150 years. That's a long time. The 20 billion year chart on the bottom is a very different scale. But see, both views, creation and evolution, are inherently religious. You have to believe in creation or believe in evolution. The difference between the two, though, is very simple. The evolution religion is tax supported. That's the difference. By the way, if I was to make that bottom chart the same scale as the top chart, the bottom chart actually needs to be 2,100 miles long. That's from Pensacola to Portland, Oregon. I don't want to carry a chart that big, so I made a new scale for the other one, okay? If they want to believe it happened long ago and far away, they're welcome to believe that, but that's not science. Evolution is a religious worldview, and I think it is stupid. So I asked the professor, where did the matter come from? He said, I don't know. I said, well, sir, would you please tell me where the laws came from? The universe is run by laws, gravity, centrifugal force, inertia. Who gave the laws? He said, we don't know that either. I said, sir, could you tell me where the energy came from? You know, it takes energy to make a big bang. Who bought the gas to run this machine anyway? He said, we don't know that either. I said, sir, could I ask you another question? He said, sure. What else would you like to know? Else? What do you mean, else? You haven't told me nothing yet. I said, does Berkeley have a merry-go-round? How many of you know what a merry-go-round is? You go round and round and round until you puke, okay? He said, no, we don't have a merry-go-round at Berkeley. I said, you ought to get one. You could learn some good science on a merry-go-round. If you put some fourth graders on a merry-go-round, are there any fourth graders in here tonight? Who's in fourth grade? All right, I like fourth graders. I spent the best 5 years of my life in the fourth grade. That's before they diagnosed ADD. Put some fourth graders on the merry-go-round. I like using fourth graders because they're tough and they're expendable. And we're going to get the high school football team out there to get that thing spinning clockwise as fast as it will possibly go. Now, if you have a digital watch, you may not know what clockwise means. I'll explain it later. We're going to spin the merry-go-round clockwise. The kids are going to go through four phases. They start off in phase one. They're screaming at the football players, come on, let's go, faster, faster, can't you go any faster? You get up around 30 miles an hour. The kids enter phase two, where they stop screaming. They just quietly concentrate on trying to hang on for dear life. You get up around 60 miles an hour. The kids enter phase three, where they start screaming again. But now they're screaming, stop, stop, please, slow down. Don't stop, though. Keep going faster and faster. When you get to about 100 miles an hour, you should enter phase four. That's where the kids begin to fly off the merry-go-round. And when this happens, you will notice a very interesting phenomena of physics. If the merry-go-round is going clockwise, when the kid flies off, the kid will be spinning clockwise until he encounters resistance, like a tree or telephone pole. That's because of a law in physics known as the conservation of angular momentum. You see, if a spinning object breaks apart in a frictionless environment, the fragments will all spin the same direction. It's very simple. It's because the outside is moving faster than the inside. And so it keeps the same direction of spin. The professor said, yes, I understand about the conservation of angular momentum. I said, well, good. I'd like to ask you a question then, sir. If the whole universe began as a swirling dot, like you said, why do two planets spin backwards? He said, that's interesting. I said, no, that's more than interesting. It's kind of hard on your Big Bang theory. Not only that, six of the moons are spinning backwards. Why? He said, I don't know. Why do you think they're going backwards? I was hoping he was going to ask that. I said, well, sir, I believe it's very simple. You see, I believe in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth, and God did it that way on purpose, just to make the Big Bang Theory look stupid. I do believe in the Big Bang, folks. I really do. The Bible teaches the Big Bang. 2 Peter 3:10 says, the heavens shall pass away with a great noise. In the original Greek, that's a Big Bang. So there's going to be a Big Bang. It just didn't happen yet, that's all. So kids, if you go to school and some professor says, do you believe in the Big Bang? You should say, yes, I do, and you better get saved and get ready for it. The Big Bang is coming soon to a city near you. By the way, if the Big Bang theory were true, the matter would be evenly distributed. But it's not. It's lumpy. They're called galaxies. And in zillions of miles and nothing called voids. And to try to salvage the dumb Big Bang theory, they've got all these wild theories of why isn't the matter evenly distributed? They'll say, well, maybe there's black holes, or maybe there's antimatter. They got all this stuff. It's all trying to rescue this crazy Big Bang theory. And it's a dud, folks. It didn't happen. There are zillions of stars out there. I mean, lots and lots of stars. And we haven't even seen them all. If star births, they ought to at least equal star deaths, and they don't. We see a star blow up about every 30 years. It's called a nova or a supernova. Well, then how come there are only 300 dead stars out there that we can see, supernovas? Huh. That's only a few thousand years worth, isn't it? There ought to be trillions of them, if evolution were true. This fellow said, I have a little hesitation in saying that a sickly pall now hangs over the Big Bang Theory. Yep. I think it is stupid. Now, if you want to believe it, that's fine. I don't care what anybody believes. That doesn't bother me. But see, the problem is, they want to use my tax dollars to teach that to your kids in our schools. And that's where the problem comes in. Okay? If you want to believe in the Big Bang, just enjoy yourself. But keep your religion at home. Okay? Because it is a religion. Then they tell the kids, the earth formed from a hot molten mass 4.6 billion years ago. This is part of the theory, and it's in all the textbooks. 4.6 billion years ago, earth cooled down, formed a rocky crust. I think that is stupid, and I'll show you why. Was the earth ever really a hot molten mass 4.6 billion years ago, and it cooled down? This textbook says, as earth formed, the surface was like the moon. There were hot pools of bubbling lava. I don't think so. My Bible says, the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. So the earth was not created a hot molten mass, it was created under water, which means it has to be less than 212 degrees Fahrenheit or 100 degrees centigrade, or it wouldn't be water, it'd be steam. So the earth was never a hot molten mass, according to Scripture. Then when you look in the granite rocks, you find little tiny halos made of polonium. Now these polonium halos are absolutely amazing. Robert Gentry, a friend of mine from Knoxville, Tennessee area, he has been studying radio polonium halos for a long time. I met him back in the year 2000 and went down to his laboratory and I got to see some of the halos through the microscope. These little polonium halos are interesting because they have a half-life of less than a few minutes. If the rock was hot when the polonium, radioactive polonium, decayed and sent out the little particles and made the halo, it would melt away. Like on 4th of July, they shoot fireworks up. Makes a circle. Does the circle stay there? No, it all falls down, right? There are probably none up there now from the last 4th of July, are there? You'd have to freeze the whole atmosphere to keep that sphere in place. This polonium would have to be decaying in a rock that is already solid. So the earth was never a hot molten mass. Get Robert Gentry's book if you want a lot more on that. But all over the granites all over the world contain these polonium halos. So it is stupid to say the earth was a hot molten mass. We have scientific evidence it was not. Here they tell the kids, though, the earth was hot with large pools of bubbling lava, and that is just stupid. It can't possibly be true. Then they tell them life got started about 3 billion years ago. See, according to the theory, 20 billion years ago there was a big bang. 4.6 billion years ago the earth cooled down, formed a hard rocky crust, and it rained on the rocks for millions of years and turned them into soup. And the soup came alive about 3 billion years ago. This is what the books teach. This fellow says, both the origin of life and the origin of major groups of animals remains unknown. How did life get started anyway? Well, this textbook tells the kids, oceans formed as it rained on the rocks for millions of years. Yes, boys and girls, millions of years of torrential rains created great oceans. And swirling in the waters of the oceans is a bubbling broth of complex chemicals. Progress from a complex chemical soup to a living organism is very slow. Well, I guess it is. It's totally stopped. Doesn't even happen. That's how slow it is. This one says, the first self-replicating systems must have emerged in this organic soup. Was your great 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 grandpa soup? I think that's stupid. Okay. Now, if they want to believe it, that's fine. I don't care what they believe, but don't call it science. What happened back in the 1950s, a guy named Miller and Urey wanted to know how the Earth and solar system had come to be. So they tell the kids, he took a mixture of Earth's primitive atmosphere. We'll talk about that in a minute. He never proved how life originated, but he did add evidence to the theory that life could have started by itself. Well, is that true? Now, did he really do that? Well, let's just study the facts here. This textbook tells the kids, many important events occurred during the Archean era, the most important of which was the evolution of life. Progress from complex molecules to even simplest living organism was a very long process. Long ago and far away. Fairy tale, kids, coming up. First living cells emerged 4 billion to 3.8 billion years ago. I like that word, emerge. They use it all the time. Like that explains how it happened, you know? It just emerged. There is no record of the event, they tell the kids. Look, kid, we know what happened, and you're going to be tested on this, but there's no proof. Oh, okay. It's not science. First living self-replicating systems must have emerged in this soup. I don't think so. Here's what students are taught in school. This picture of the different glass tubes and flasks and pipes going around, they tell them this is how they made life in the laboratory. He said he studied the chemical reactions of gases that existed in Earth's primitive atmosphere. Ooh, now this is important, okay? Notice up in the upper right-hand corner, he had methane, ammonia, water vapor, and hydrogen. No oxygen. He circulated these gases through these tubes through a spark supposed to represent lightning. And sure enough, it produced a red goo at the bottom of the flask and had some amino acids in it. It didn't come close to getting life, though. Miller excluded oxygen in a reducing atmosphere because life could not evolve with oxygen. Anything that got together would oxidize. Cut a banana open, lay it on the table, it'll turn brown, it'll oxidize. Okay, so will an apple, so will anything alive. It'll oxidize. So that's why he didn't have any oxygen in the experiment. One of his guesses was ammonia. Well, this creates a real serious problem because ammonia is destroyed by UV light. And UV light must be blocked by ozone, which is made from oxygen. I got a problem here. This textbook says several billion years ago, Earth's atmosphere had no free oxygen. Well, that's just simply not true. Ozone is made from oxygen, and it blocks UV light, and ammonia, one of the gases needed for the experiment, is destroyed by UV light. So life cannot evolve without oxygen. But also life cannot evolve with oxygen. Well, I got a solution for that one. It didn't evolve. And by the way, the Earth has always had oxygen, even more than it does today. Okay? Air bubbles are often found trapped in amber, like the movie Jurassic Park, you know, where they drilled in and got the mosquito blood. These air bubbles, though, have 50% more oxygen than we do right now. We cover more on that on my video series, videotape number 2, about what the pre-flood world was like and why they lived to be 900 on the blue series of tapes out there on the table. But this textbook says, the mixture at the bottom of the flask was rich in amino acids. Oh, come on. That is stupid. It was not rich in amino acids. Let's tell the kids what they really found, okay? He filtered out the product. As this gas went through the tubes, he sparked it, produced this goo at the bottom, and he drew the goo off because if it went through again, it would be destroyed by the spark. Now, in real life, you're not going to get a section of the ocean protected. They say this just happened by chance in the ocean. Well, you can't filter out the product then. Secondly, what he made was 85% tar, 13% carboxylic acid, 2% amino acids. So 98% of his mixture was poisonous to life. I would not call that a success. And there are 20 different amino acids, sort of like 26 letters in the alphabet. There are 20 amino acids. Those amino acids go together to make proteins, like letters go together to make sentences. Mostly, he made just 2 of these amino acids. And they bond with the tar and the acid very quickly, more readily than with each other. It was a failure as an experiment. Amino acids are like letters of the alphabet, sort of like building blocks. You have to have a bunch of amino acids to make a protein. Then you have to have a bunch of proteins to make a cell. And you got to have a bunch of cells to make an organism. And one cell is more complex than a space shuttle. And all he got was a couple of the amino acids. That's like me dropping toothpicks, and I happen to make a few letters of the alphabet. That's possible, isn't it? Toothpicks could fall in the shape of a T, or an H, or an I, or an E. That's possible. But if I'm able to drop toothpicks and produce a few letters of the alphabet, should I therefore conclude that nobody wrote Webster's dictionary? The difference between making a letter with toothpicks and making Webster's dictionary is about like making an amino acid and making a living cell. He didn't come close to making life. He made the equivalent of a few letters, and he actually needed to make huge books. And half of his letters were backwards, left-handed. This creates a real problem, since the simplest proteins, the smallest proteins, have 70 to 100 amino acids, all of them left-handed. This really compounds his problem. RNA and DNA are all right-handed molecules, and they are unbelievably complex. And hundreds of these amino acids must combine to make a protein, and this has to be in a precise order. And they unbond in water much faster than they bond, and last time I checked, the oceans are completely full of water. So Brownian motion is going to drive them away from each other, not together. It just isn't going to work. He did not make life in the laboratory. But they tell the kids, he showed how life could have started by itself. Oh, that is just a stupid, okay? That's a lie. He did not show anything of the kind. And every experiment since then has made the problem worse. They're finding more and more things that just couldn't happen. Don't call that science. But they tell the kids, 3 billion years ago, life appeared on Earth. Asked me to speak at this college in Boston one time. This preacher called all the colleges and universities around Boston and said, would you like to have Kent Hovind come speak at your college? Finally, one professor said, yes, he can come speak at our school if our professors can ask him any questions they want, because we want to show our students how dumb these creationists really are. So the preacher called me and said, Brother Hovind, would you like to speak at this college and let them make fun of you for a couple hours? I said, I would be honored. So I showed up. There were 6 professors and all their students. I felt like Daniel in the lion's den. I got my charts out and I said, now folks, I believe the Bible. Nobody cheered. I said, I believe about 6,000 years ago God made everything. The world's not millions of years old. 4.6 billion years ago, there was a big flood. I'm sorry, 4,400 years ago, there was a big flood. Not 4.6. And 2,000 years ago, Jesus came, and I gave them the basic Bible story, okay? Then I told them what they believe. Because most of them don't know what they believe. You have to tell them. You guys believe 20 billion years ago there was a big bang where nothing exploded and produced everything. 4.6 billion years ago the earth cooled down, made a hard rocky crust, it rained on the rocks for millions of years, turned them into soup, and the soup came alive 3 billion years ago. And this early life form found somebody to marry. Boy, now that's a good trick. And something to eat, of course, and slowly evolved into everything we see today. One professor was getting kind of upset about this time. I seem to do that to them. He said, Mr. Hovind, there are hundreds of varieties of dogs in the world. I said, yes, sir, you're right about that. He said, you mean to tell me that you believe all these dogs came from 2 dogs off of Noah's Ark? You expect me to believe that? Ha, ha, ha. I said, sir, would you look at what you're teaching your students? You're teaching your students that all the dogs in the world came from a rock. I had one lady, a woman, come to me after a debate one time. She was steaming down the aisle, boy, she was mad. Oh, I could tell, I'm in trouble now. I stood there quivering in my boots, She walked up and she said, tonight, you said, we believe we come from a rock. We do not believe that. I said, well, ma'am, calm down just for a minute. I said, do you believe in evolution? She said, yes, I do. I'm a professor here at the university. I said, well, would you please tell me then where we came from? She said, we came from a macromolecule. I said, where did that come from? She said, from the oceans, from the prebiotic soup. I said, where did that come from? She said, well, it rained on the rocks for millions of years. And you could see it was slowly dawning on her. I do believe I come from a rock, don't I? Yes, ma'am, you do. You ought to be proud of it. Hey, don't step on Grandpa, whatever you do. Look, that's stupid, okay? There's no kind way to say it. There's a great book dealing with some of the flaws in the Miller experiment. If you want more on that for your kids to study out there on the table, get the book Icons of Evolution. Then they tell the kids that these plants and animals, not only did life evolve from non-living material, then this life had to learn to reproduce itself. Why would any organism want to reproduce more of its own kind when that's only going to increase competition for the food supply? Why didn't they instead evolve the ability to live forever and be happy? Huh? You ever think about that? I was in a debate one time, and we had question and answer time at the end. The student stood up, and he said to the evolutionist, he said, sir, how did male and female evolve? The professor got up, and he said, well, that is a giant mother may I step in the evolution story? A mother, may I step? This is science. Wow. So according to them, you know, for the next few billion years or hundreds of millions of years, you know, life learned to produce something other than its own kind. Of course, today everything only produces its own kind, but they say long ago and far away, they were able to do something different. Textbooks will say we started like a bacteria and slowly evolved to a human. I think that's stupid. But if you want to believe that, that's perfectly fine. Those trees of life that they put in the textbooks for your kids are a bunch of nonsense. And even evolutionists will admit that. Stephen Jay Gould, the Marxist professor at Harvard University, he says that evolutionary trees that adorn our textbooks are not the evidence of fossils. It's only inference. We infer, we imply, we hope it happened this way. This textbook says, all the many forms of life on Earth today are descended from a common ancestor. What? You mean the birds and the bananas have a common ancestor? Isn't that what he says? Found in a population of primitive unicellular organisms. Well, in the first place, there's no such thing as a primitive unicellular organism, okay? One single cell is more complex than a space shuttle. There's no such thing as a primitive single-celled organism. We talk about that on video number 4 of our series. But he says, all the forms of life are descended from a common ancestor found in a population of primitive unicellular organisms. What were those first cells like? How do we know? What events led up to their formation? No traces of those events remain. Did you catch that? Hey kid, we know what happened, but there's no proof. Primitive, huh? This one says, the humans, mammals, birds, crocodiles, all had a common ancestor. Well, anything inside that circle is religious speculation. It is stupid. Reptiles produce reptiles, dogs produce dogs, people produce people, and there's never been an exception to that. Darwin said, though, if my theory be true, here's his book right here, you can look on page 211, he said, if my theory be true, numberless intermediate varieties must assuredly have existed. Boy, you're right about that, Charlie. I mean, to change from a rock to a dog would take a few changes. David Robb, who believes in evolution very strongly, says, in the years after Darwin, his advocates hoped to find predictable progressions. In general, these have not been found, yet the optimism has died hard, and some pure fantasy has crept into textbooks. Oh, you're kidding. Fantasy in our textbooks? Oh, yep. They tell the kids they have evidence of evolution from fossils. I don't think so. That is stupid, okay? If you find a fossil in the dirt, all you know is it died. You don't know that it had any kids, do you? And you sure don't know that it had different kids. I mean, think about it. You're in a court of law. You bring in a bone to the judge. Judge, I found this bone in the dirt. This is the ancestor of all the humans today. They would laugh at you. You don't know that that's the ancestor of anybody, do you? And why on earth would you think a bone in the dirt can do something animals today cannot do? Animals today can only produce the same kind, right? Dogs produce dogs, folks. Luther Sunderland asked all the major evolutionists, he said, where is the evidence for evolution? They all said, well, somebody else has it. We don't have it over here. So he wrote a letter to Colin Paterson. He's the director of the British Museum of Natural History. They've got the largest fossil collection in the world. He said, Mr. Paterson, I read your book on evolution. I noticed you didn't show us the missing links. Why didn't you show us the missing links? Paterson wrote back and said, I fully agree with your comments on the lack of evolutionary transitions in my book. If I knew of any, fossil or living, I would certainly have included them. I will lay it on the line, there is not one such fossil. There are no missing links, folks. No chain is missing. Even Stephen Gould admitted, the absence of fossil evidence for intermediary stages is a persistent and nagging problem for evolution. We got the theory, we know it's true, now we just need the evidence. That's the way they think about it. Richard Goldschmidt said, maybe the first bird hatched from a reptile egg. Oh, Richard, I'm sorry. I don't mean to be disrespectful, but that's stupid. See, what's happened, these guys have looked for missing links in the fossil record. They can't find any, and so they say, well, maybe evolution happened so fast it wasn't preserved. Maybe a reptile laid an egg and a bird hatched out. Well, who did that bird marry? There's only about a zillion differences between a reptile and a bird. We'll get into that later sometime if we get time. But if they want to believe that, that's perfectly fine. Here's what happened. Charlie Darwin graduated from Bible college to be a preacher in the Anglican Church in 1830. He couldn't get a job, so his dad pulled a few strings and got him a job on board HMS Beagle. He's going to sail around the world and collect bugs. And while he's sailing around, he stopped off at these islands right there called the Galapagos Islands. There on those islands, Charlie noticed there were 14 different varieties of finches. Charlie studied the birds very carefully and said, "You know what? I think all these birds had a common ancestor." "I bet you're right, Charlie. It was a bird." And then Charlie said in his book on page 170, he said, "It is a truly wonderful fact that all animals and all plants throughout all time and space should be related to each other." Hold on a minute. You see 14 kinds of birds and you conclude that birds and bananas are related. That's stupid. You should conclude that those 14 kinds of birds had a common ancestor, but that's as far as it ever goes, folks, okay? I don't know of a kind way to say it, Charlie, but that's stupid. Okay, we don't ever see a bird produce a non-bird. See, dogs produce dogs, and you might get quite a variety of dogs. Roses produce roses. That is called microevolution. Now, that is a fact, folks. It happens. It is observable. It is scientific. I don't think we ought to use that word, microevolution. We should just call it a variation. But they use it, so I qualify that. It's a lousy term. It gives what's called a free rider effect to the rest of the five religious ideas of evolution. You might get a big dog or a little dog, but you're always going to get a dog when you crossbreed your dogs. And I would go so far as to say probably the dog, the wolf, and the coyote had a common ancestor. This Irish textbook shows different dogs and it calls it divergent evolution. Oh, come on, giving it a fancy name doesn't change a thing. It is still a dog. And a three-year-old can tell you. Anybody in here 5 years old? Who's 5 years old? 5 years old. What's your name? Misty. Here we have a dog, a wolf, a coyote, and a banana. Which one is not like the others? Dog, wolf, coyote, and banana. Banana. All right, let's give Misty a hand. Very good. Another ones. Some of these college professors can't tell. Look, there's a variety of dogs, folks, and they probably had a common ancestor. It was a dog. Okay? It's just a dog. See, variations happen within the dog kind. You get a big dog or a little dog, but there are limits to these variations. Haven't the farmers been trying to breed for bigger pigs for a long time? They try to get the biggest pig they can, don't they? Do you think they'll ever get a pig as big as Texas? I bet there's a limit in there somewhere, isn't there? Mm-hmm. Roaches become resistant to pesticides after a while. Do you think they'll ever become resistant to a sledgehammer? I bet there's a limit. Yeah. Okay. They still produce the same kind of plant or animal. That's not evolution. That's just a variation of the same kind. Okay. And the information for that variety was already present in the gene pool. No new information is ever added. The dogs or the pigs don't learn to fly or become pink. Okay. There's no new information added, just scrambled information. And the gene pool of the new variety is now more limited than before. Somebody spent years crossbreeding dogs to develop a Chihuahua. All that work to make a dog that is 100% useless. Let's turn all the Chihuahuas in the world loose back into the woods. How long would they last? They'd run up to the wolf. Yep, 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 yep. Crunch. Go ahead, make my day. A useless dog. Genetic information was lost when you got your variation. It wasn't added. You might have selected a certain slice of the gene pool with small dog, quick characteristics, but you didn't add anything. You selected something from the population. I come from Illinois, corn country. There are so many kinds of corn up there, they have to number them. You'll be driving down the highway. You'll see BX65. Don't mix it up with XL29. Something will blow up. But I'll tell you what, folks, you can crossbreed your corn from now until the cows come home, and you always get corn. You will never get a hamster or a tomato or a whale to grow on that corn stalk, okay? It won't happen. There's a variety of cows, and they probably had a common ancestor. It was a cow. Variety of horses, no question. Probably the zebra and the horse had a common ancestor. But the kids are going to be taught in school tomorrow in your town that the horse used to have four toes. Well, there's some things they don't tell the kids about this Eohippus to Equus series, which has been proven wrong 50 years ago, but still is in your textbooks right here in this town. They don't tell them the original so-called horse is the size of a fox. It was a meat eater and had 18 pairs of ribs. The next one had 15 pairs of ribs. A couple of trips through the buzzsaw did that. And then it miraculously grew back 19 pairs of ribs as it evolved, and then back to 18. They also don't tell them the whole thing's been proven wrong a long time ago. Like this guy says in the biology textbook, other examples like the gradual evolution of the horse have not held up under close examination. That's a polite way of saying it's proven wrong, okay? This G.G. Simpson back in 1950 said the example of the horse family has been unintentionally falsified. They knew 50 years ago this was false. Why did they keep that in your textbooks? This whole thing was made up by Othniel C. Marsh in 1874. He picked animals from all over the world and put them in order the way he thought it might have happened. They were never found in that order. Modern horses are found in the same layers as the so-called ancient Equus or Eohippus horse. They're found in the same layer. So it can't be the ancestor, that's for sure. The ancient horse is nothing but a Hyracotherium, which is still alive today. By the way, the ribs, the toes, the teeth are very different in these animals. In South America, the fossils go exactly backwards. Instead of three-toed to one-toed, it goes one-toed to three-toed in the fossil order. They won't talk about that much, but you check it out. That's a fact, folks. They're never found in the order presented in the textbooks. Three-toed and one-toed gray side by side. Plenty of information on the internet about that. Tulsa Zoo finally took out their display because so many folks complain. Why do you have this horse evolution display in the zoo? It's been proven wrong 50 years ago. Take it out. And you folks ought to get together with your school board and say, look, on page whatever it is, 952 of our textbook, it says the horse evolved from a four-toed ancestor. Let's cut this page out. If you had a page in your textbook teaching the kids the earth was flat, would it be okay to demand that page be removed? You don't have to buy a whole new book. Just cut the page out. It won't cost the school anything. How many of you would volunteer to help cut the pages out and bring your own scissors? See? Won't cost them a dime. And you send me your book, and I'll show you which pages need to be taken out. I've read hundreds of them. I can find them like that. Free of charge. I'll donate my time. Peabody Museum still has the horse evolution on display. As I stood there, I've been there many times. It makes my blood boil every time I walk in that place. I'm standing there looking at this lie proven wrong 50 years ago while hundreds of kids come through in school groups. The kids are never told, well, this has been proven wrong, boys and girls. They asked the folks at the Tulsa Zoo before they took the display down, they said, why don't you take this display down? The zoo director said, we don't have the funding to remove it. I've got all the letters back and forth on that. Man, folks, there's quite a variety of horses today, okay? There's big horses and little horses. I was in Baton Rouge, Louisiana a few months ago, got to see where they raised the 30-inch tall horses. I mean, my dog's bigger than that. What do you do with a 30-inch horse? Look at it, I guess is about it. And they sell them for $10,000. Sucker born every minute, I guess. But one lady wrote me a letter and said, Mr. Hovind, we crossbreed zebras, ponies, horses, and we raise zonkies, zorses, zionies. They cross every which way. Well, that's probably because they're the original same kind. No problem there. I want to see all the fatal flaws in the horse evolution story. Get the book out there, Icons of Evolution. So, then they're going to tell the kids, well, we have evidence for this theory. We think that one animal changed to another, and we can show evidence because many animals have similar forelimb structure. This is called the argument from homology. Well, what do they tell the kids? They'll say, boys and girls, you have two bones in your wrist, radius and ulna. Mm-hmm. And boys and girls, look at the whale's flipper carefully. Did you know the whale has two bones in his flipper, and they're called the radius and the ulna? Same as ours. Wow. Who named them, teacher? The whale? Think about it. But this is one of the evidences for evolution. They're going to say, boys and girls, comparative anatomy provides further evidence of evolution. The commonalities suggest these and other vertebrate animals are all related. They probably evolved from a common ancestor. Well, duh. That's stupid, okay? Maybe they all had the same designer. Doesn't prove a common ancestor. By the way, the bones develop from different genes in these different organisms. They are not homologous organisms like they want you to believe. Similar design might prove the same engineer made the design. A lot of bridges in the world are kind of similar to each other. You can go compare, different suspension bridges around the world, Golden Gate Bridge and other bridges, and there's a lot of similarities. That doesn't prove one is the father of the other, or that a tornado put them up. No, it's a design that works good, okay? I discovered that the Pontiac lug nuts from a Pontiac will fit on a Chevy. They will. That proves they both evolved from a Honda 14 million years ago. No, the same engineers are designing these cars. Then they tell the kids about the geologic column. How many have ever heard that the different layers of the earth are different ages? They show the kids Grand Canyon. Yes, boys and girls, this one says, over millions of years, the Colorado River has carved the Grand Canyon from solid rock. I'm sorry, but that is stupid. Okay, I'll explain why. Kids, you need to learn this. This is a very simple thing to learn, and you'll go through life much further than many of these professors go. Make yourself three columns. Facts are in the middle. It's a fact Grand Canyon exists. The evolutionist has an interpretation of that fact, and the creationist has an interpretation of the fact. That's not part of the fact, it's an interpretation of the fact. The evolutionist says the canyon forms slowly by a little bit of water and lots of time. The creationist says, oh no, we think it formed quickly by lots of water and a little bit of time. It's a fact the earth has sedimentary layers, that's not a question. How did they get there? Well, the evolutionist says these layers form slowly over millions of years. The creationist says, oh no, these layers are all from the flood in the days of Noah. Now, it seems like the professors are always trying to erase the line between their interpretation and the fact and make their interpretation part of the fact column, and it's not. And I think I can demonstrate Grand Canyon was not formed by the Colorado River. I was in a debate recently, and this professor said, Dr. Hovind, you're so stupid. Obviously, it took millions of years to form the Grand Canyon. I said, well, sir, I've seen Grand Canyon many times. I taught her science for 15 years. I've studied it intensively. Just flew over it last week, as a matter of fact, twice. Got a perfect view of it going out to California and back, flying from wherever I was, Florida. That's where I live. This textbook says, the Colorado River has cut through layer upon layer of rock over millions of years. Well, if you built a dam across Grand Canyon, it would take a lot of dirt or concrete, but if you could, okay, it'd be a huge dam. A giant lake would back up behind that dam, covering several states. That purple area is all drained right through the Grand Canyon drainage basin. This snow line tells a very interesting story. In between these two red lines is snow. This is a picture from a satellite showing about 150 or 200 miles of the canyon area. Real wide shot. The river enters the canyon at the far right. The river is 2,800 feet above sea level. As it goes down through the canyon, the ground is rising up. It's called the Kaibab uplift, okay? The uplift is 7,000 or 8,000 feet above sea level. Interesting. The river flows downhill. All rivers flow downhill. So as the river enters the canyon and flows downhill from there, when it gets to the 1,800-foot elevation mark, the top of the canyon is 7,000 or 8,000 feet above sea level, so it's over a one-mile drop. Very impressive, hole in the ground. But some things, points to ponder. I said to the professor, I said, sir, did you know the top is higher than the bottom? He said, yeah. I said, did you know the river only runs through the bottom? He said, yeah. I said, sir, the top is higher than where the river enters the canyon by 4,000 feet. Rivers don't flow uphill. There's no delta. Where's all the mud that washed out? There's no way that river made that canyon. Grand Canyon is a breached dam, a spillway that washed out. There was a lake probably for some length of time after the flood. It got too full and all that water went roaring through there. Probably carved that canyon out in a couple of weeks. Not millions of years. Absolutely impossible for that river to have made that canyon. We cover lots more on that on videotape number 6 of our series. But they tell the kids, the Colorado River made this canyon slowly over millions of years. I'm sorry, that is stupid. That can't possibly be true. They need to learn the facts. Charlie Lyell, back in 1830, he was a lawyer from Scotland. Somebody calculated one time that if all the lawyers in the world were laid end to end around the equator, we would all be better off. Charlie Lyell hated the Bible. In 1830, he wrote this book right here. Oh, I got it on the table. I picked up the wrong one. Principles of Geology. Here it is on this table. Charlie Lyell wrote this book, 1830. In this book, he mocked at scriptures. He hated the Bible. You can see it mocking all through the here. In here, he and other fellows back in that time, Cuvier, Steno, Strata Smith, and some of these guys, they invented the geologic column. How many have ever heard of the geologic column before? They say each of the layers is a different age. You know, Cenozoic, Mesozoic, Paleozoic, Archaeozoic, all them Zoic boys. And they gave each layer of rock a name, like maybe you saw the movie Jurassic Park, and an age, and an index fossil. This was done in 1830, way before there ever was a carbon dating, or potassium-argon dating, or lead-208, lead-206, uranium-235, uranium-238. Didn't exist, folks. The dating text didn't exist. They just made up these numbers out of the clear blue sky. The geologic column is the Bible for the evolutionist. It can only be found one place in the world, the textbooks. There is no geologic column, and they know it. This fellow says, if there were a column of sediments, unfortunately, no such column exists. The geologic column is a hoax. It does not exist. It is stupid. Those layers cannot be different ages. If the geologic column were all in one place, it would be 100 miles thick. Didn't happen. By the way, if the geologic column were true, if you look at the side of Grand Canyon and see all these thousands of layers, why are there no erosion marks between the layers? Don't you think if one layer sat there for 10 million years waiting for the next one, it would rain once or twice? No erosion marks between the layers. Interesting. Something to consider anyway. Those layers are all deposited very rapidly, and I think we can demonstrate that scientifically. If you take a jar of dirt, put some water in it, and shake it up, and set it down, it'll settle into layers for you automatically. It just takes a few minutes. It's called hydrologic sorting. The gravels go to the bottom, and then the sands and the silts and the clays. It'll sort just like that, folks. Go home and do it with a jar. You'll see what I'm talking about. Years ago, I was preaching in Union Center, South Dakota. Union Center is right there. It's not even on the map. There are 40 people in the whole town. 38 of them came to church. I don't know where the other two were. But they showed up later, I guess. The preacher said, hey, Brother Hovind, let's go down to Rabbit City, South Dakota. They've got a museum down there with a bunch of dinosaur bones.